From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Humane Society of the U.S. pleads with Dow and a laboratory in West Michigan to stop doing toxic chemical tests on beagles and adopt out the test dogs.
There are much more efficient, inexpensive, and entirely humane ways to test these products.
How to connect Michigan's veterans to the benefits they may be entitled to.
There are certain benefits I feel like are harder to find out about, and if somebody doesn't tell you, if you don't really do research, then you may never find them.
The coming-of-age story of a Detroit boy told through the music he loves.
Whatever kids are listening to, music just becomes so important, I think, as far as establishing their identity.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We begin today with the Humane Society of the United States calling on a West Michigan laboratory to adopt out dogs being used in toxicity tests. Dogs, it says, are scheduled to be destroyed at the end of the experiments. With us now is Kitty Block, president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, here with us from Arlington, Virginia. Kitty, your group, the Humane Society of the United States, conducted an undercover investigation into testing on dogs. Your report covers several tests in more than one location, but we're going to focus on testing being done now in West Michigan at the Charles River Laboratories in Mattawan near Kalamazoo. When did this undercover investigation happen, and what did your investigators find at the Charles River Labs?
Well, thank you for hearing us out and taking on this really important story. So our investigators, it started in this past summer, and they were there for about 100 days. And so what they did was, while they were there, they were documenting a case of a number of animals being essentially poisoned every day with product testing, toxicity product testing. And then while they were there, at the end of the time they were there, these dogs were all euthanized and then necropsied. So it was a pretty intense time for our investigators to see this. Beagles in particular are really gentle animals, dogs, and that's why they are picked for these tests. So the Humane Society of the United States is really focusing on dogs in research, and in particular, this one year toxicity test where dogs are poisoned every single day, when our Environmental Protection Agency said this test is no longer necessary for products.
And this test is particularly, this is the focus that is in your report and in your release on a one-year test commissioned by Dow testing a new fungicide called Adavelt?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Tell us about that test.
So this is a test, really it's a pesticide that they're trying to see what levels are toxic. And so they dose the dogs every day. These tubes put down their throat, and then they fill the tubes with these toxins, these poisons. And then they continue to assess and monitor these animals. I mean, the test lasts for a year, if you can imagine how horrible that is. Some don't make it the whole year, but if they do make it the whole year, then they are euthanized at the end and studied. But the thing is, this test, this one-year test, has been deemed unnecessary, and most of the global community no longer endorses this one-year test.
Deemed unnecessary by the United States government?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The United States government said this test is no longer needed. No longer needed for products, the one-year test.
Okay.
And so the test that we're talking about today that's in all our materials that are being conducted on these 36 beagles, this is part of the one-year test. We want this to stop. It's unnecessary. It's been deemed not even useful. And we want to get these dogs out of the lab and to work with us to find forever homes for these dogs.
All right. And so this is a one-year pesticide test for Corteva Agriscience, which is the agriculture division of Dow DuPont. Is this laboratory owned by Dow, Kitty, or is this a contract arrangement?
It is not owned by Dow. It's a contract arrangement, as do other companies use this facility.
Okay. And when we're talking about these three dozen beagles, particularly in this test for Adavelt, where do these dogs come from?
They are usually come from dealers that breed specifically these animals for lab testing. Not all the time, but that's in large part where they do come from. And so these dogs are bred and then sold to these labs for the testing.
And you touched on this, but just to elaborate a little bit, why are beagles preferred for this kind of testing?
Beagles have such a very calm demeanor. They are gentle dogs. They are easy to breed, and their sort of makeup is lends itself to the type of test that they would do. And so it, unfortunately for them, it's great when they're your household pet, but it is particularly challenging in these labs. And so that's why they tend to use beagles.
Now, Dow has issued a statement and put it online, and I'm quoting here, quote from Dow, "Animal testing is not something Dow undertakes lightly, but neither is it something the company can discontinue when it is required by regulatory authorities." That's end that quote. And as you have just said it, the U.S. government no longer requires this live animal test?
That is absolutely correct. What Dow is referring to is the product that they're testing on these three dozen beagles is for a product that will be sold in Brazil. We have a presence. We have an office in Brazil. We have been working with the Brazilian government, and though they have the law in the books that you had to do this one-year test, they have said they no longer are requiring it, and they will give a waiver to any company that doesn't want to do this one-year test. And in fact, we gave all that data to Dow, and the official information from the Brazilian government, but officials at Dow felt that they needed something, ink in writing and the law change before they would stop.
Okay.
And that just makes no sense to us. The Brazilian government said they are already giving out waivers for companies to stop this. It's just a matter until they get their law inked on the books. So these dogs are continuing to suffer entirely unnecessarily.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Kitty Block. She is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States about this group's undercover investigation into toxicity tests being performed on dogs at labs in this country. This conversation focuses on testing that the Humane Society says is being done at the Charles River Laboratories in Mattawan near Kalamazoo, a laboratory contracted to Dow. The Humane Society says three dozen beagles have been force-fed fungicides and the dogs will be destroyed at the end of the experiment, and it's calling on the lab to adopt out the beagles. When is this experiment scheduled to end?
Well, as I said, it's 1 year. There are probably four more months to go, and so it is really, a do or die to get these animals out, and we don't want any more poisons pumped into them. We want them to, and we're not even asking Dow to do the legwork of adopting. We want to partner with them. We will help them. We will take the dogs, and we will work with the shelters. We have 350 partner shelters around the country to work with these dogs, rehabilitate them, provide them necessary medical care, and get them adopted. So it's really, this is kind of one of those, no-brainer things. Let's partner on this. Mm. Let's get this right. Dow in the past has been really a good partner on trying to help other countries end these sort of test requirements. That's why it just doesn't make sense to us that this one is continuing. And we hope, better judgment and better minds will prevail, and we'll be able to partner and do the right thing on this issue.
Kitty, can a state like Michigan make this kind of testing illegal, or is this an issue that comes under the purview of federal agencies such as the Food and Drug Administration?
This is a federal issue because these products are not unique to any one state, and so any kind of drug regulating is done through FDA, EPA, and so on. So it's not up to the individual states.
Kitty, there are all sorts of chemicals that we need and we use as humans, especially when it comes to optimizing crop output to feed the world's growing population. And it is probably a good idea to test these chemicals before they're widely used. So if we don't want to test them on humans first, then how do we balance the need to ensure new scientific breakthroughs that don't harm humans while also humanely treating animals who may be involved in this research process? How do we balance that?
It's a great question. And here's an easy one. It's not really a balance because 21st century modern science the models are not animals. There's so much research on stem cell, on high throughput tests that are much more accurate for humans. I mean, for example, dogs, who doesn't love chocolate? I think I had already had two bars today. That would kill a dog. They are not models for each other. And so in many ways, it retards the development of good products. There are much more efficient, inexpensive, and entirely humane ways to test these products. And so we've just got to spend, the industry's got to just spend the time and sort of move off the old model, which is just because they always did it doesn't mean, A, that it's the right thing going forward or the best for the way to test the drugs.
And as you note in the report, this is certainly not a Michigan-only issue, and you found instances of this kind of testing elsewhere. Broadly speaking, how many dogs are tested on annually in this country?
It's about, sadly, about 67,000.
Okay. And your group has asked Dow to end the testing and release the dogs, and now you've launched an online petition on the Humane Society of the United States website calling for these dogs to be released for adoption. Have you received any response to this from Charles River Labs or from Dow?
Well, Dow, we continue to, I mean, before we launched the campaign, we were working with Dow for months to really try to get us to where we needed to be, except things got stalled. That's why we went this route. We always try to work, with the industry and bring about a good, favorable result for both. We have not heard from Charles River, but our petition, I'm happy to say, is nearly at 100,000, and we just launched it yesterday.
Kitty Block, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. Kitty, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you, too.
Stateside reached out to Dow and to Charles River's Laboratories in West Michigan. You can read both of their responding statements on the investigation and animal testing at michiganradio.org. Coming up, writer Michael Zadorian talks about his novel, Beautiful Music.
Whatever kids are listening to, music just becomes so important, I think, as far as establishing their identity.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it is Wednesday, and you know what that means. Time to talk our state's history with our partners from the Michigan History Center.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Ever wonder where a Michigan kid under age 18 goes to serve time if found guilty of a crime? Well, maybe you're picturing some sort of juvenile hall where things might not be great, but certainly better than adult prison. Well, that was not always the case. In fact, Michigan kids convicted of a crime used to be sent straight to prison until reformers came up with a new idea. Here to tell us about that is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thank you.
So let's get this straight. In the past, our state would just send convicted kids straight into adult prisons as kind of normal operating procedure?
Yes. Either they would go to Jackson Prison or county jail, depending on what their crime was. But at that time, there really wasn't another system in place for kids.
And was that pretty much the case around the world? I mean, would you have seen that in Europe? Did you see that in other states?
In various forms, yes. You had, and again, it really depended on what the kid was accused of, but you would have places that were sort of, it reminds me sort of Oliver Twist era, Dickinsonian, but you would have these homes for children, delinquent children, but you did have systems where kids would be sent to adult prisons because there just wasn't anything else.
When did we start to see people question this form of punishment?
In Michigan in the early 1850s, there were prison reports that came out indicating that there were children in prisons. So people began to question whether or not that was a system that we wanted to maintain. As Michigan's population is increasing, you're going to have people who break various laws, and something is needed to be done with them. And children were no exception to that. So early 1850s, it's decided something needs to be done. And so they start putting things into place to sort of change the system.
So what was the something that came about as a solution?
In 1855, Michigan's legislature appropriated $25,000 to build a house of correction for juvenile offenders. It was to be built somewhere around the Lansing area, according to the law. And in the first couple of years, it housed 75 boys and 8 girls. So in the ledgers for the juvenile home in Lansing, the boy number one in the ledger was actually a 15-year-old who had been in Jackson Prison for stealing a horse.
Wow. Well, then, so this was this house of correction. Is that what I've also come, I remember from way long ago. Is that a training school?
They changed the name of both. So in 1879, you get a girls' training school that opened. So this concept of training school or industrial school, those terms begin to come about in about the 1870s and 1880s. And the idea is that these people are so young and something needs to be done to prepare them for adulthood so they can go back into society and earn a living and sort of change the ways that got them into the system in the first place.
So did they actually get trained for some type of employment?
They did. The boys' school, which was built in Lansing, they started out with this idea of an indenture program. The girls' school also used an indenture program. So what they would do is send these children out into homes to work. And the theory was that they would learn some sort of trade or some sort of skill. The boys' home was finding that they didn't have enough homes to send the boys to. So the industrial school for boys in Lansing became pretty self-sufficient. They started building facilities on the school grounds where they could build furniture. They had full farms on the school grounds. So the boys stayed on the school grounds and learned trades. The girls from their training school, which was down in Adrian, they were sent out to homes to learn housekeeping skills and things that they would be able to use to become a good housewife.
And were these training schools just for the juvenile delinquents? I'm using that air quote because that was a popular phrase. Or did other children get sent there as well?
What you see in the 19th century in both the girls' training school and the boys' training school or industrial home, depending on what they're called at what time, children are being sent there for essentially crimes of poverty. They're listed out for larceny, vagrancy. The girls a lot of time are in for larceny or prostitution. And so most of the kids are in there because they're poor or they don't have anyone at home who's helping to look out for them. Now, there is the Indian Industrial School that was up in Mount Pleasant, and that was an entirely separate system. There wasn't a juvenile delinquency aspect to that. Those children wound up there because they were taken from their homes and sent there by the counties and by the state. And that was an entirely separate system under the same name, but that was used essentially to get rid of the culture of indigenous people in Michigan.
So what were the results back to the other system of training schools, as you say, separate from the one in Mount Pleasant for the indigenous people? What were the results of the training schools? Was it good, bad, or somewhere in between?
I think it depends on who you talk to and when. There are stories of young people who went through the training schools program and came out on the other end and lived very sort of normal lives as citizens of the state of Michigan. You also have stories of abuse and neglect within the system. So it really depends on the person. There are punishment records for the boys' industrial school. So even just looking into those, you can see that the life of some of the boys in the late 19th century, it was rough. It was not necessarily an enjoyable time.
Hmm. Does Michigan still have training schools?
No, not in the way that they were before. The boys' industrial school or the boys' training school, again, depending on what you want to call it, that closed in 1972. The girls' training school actually closed in 2008. That one lasted much longer. And then the Indian Industrial Boarding School closed in 1934. So the state of Michigan only currently operates 2 juvenile facilities. The rest are county run. And the system that is in place is designed to not incarcerate children under 17. They try very, very hard to figure out what's going on with that child, to keep them at home if possible. So the system is very different. The two facilities in place are for youthful offenders who, for one reason or another, cannot go home. So the system is very different today.
All right. So, you know, looking at where we are today, there's a legislative effort coming up.
There's an effort in place in Michigan now. It's called the Raise the Age Bill, and it's to raise the age of adult offenders to 18 and view 17-year-olds more as a juvenile offender. And it goes a lot into brain studies and how children and young adults actually think. So there's a big movement right now to sort of look at 17-year-olds more as children and look at them holistically in their home life and possible mental health issues and substance abuse issues, as opposed to trying them as an adult and having a 17-year-old wind up in an adult prison for an indefinite number of years.
Michigan's training schools and their history. We want to thank, as always, Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
No matter your age, your generation, the music that you listen to in high school claims a great big piece of your heart. For so many kids, music is the thing that gets them through the many trials and tribulations of high school and all the changes life throws at you. And that's the foundation for the latest novel from Michael Zadorian. Beautiful Music is set in the early 70s in Detroit. It shows us how an insecure, not cool kid named Danny Yazemski uses radio and his favorite music to get through Redford High School and through trouble and tragedy at home. This is Michael Zadorian's third novel. His second, The Leisure Seeker, became a movie starring Helen Mirren and Donald Sutherland. Here's my conversation with Michael Zadorian. Tell us more about Danny and his family.
I mean, first and foremost, he is an innocent. He's barely, when we encounter him, I think he's 10 years old, and he's already a sheltered kid.
An only child,
a kind of insecure, anxiety-ridden little nerd. So we see after that initial part, which is takes place in 1969, which is just 2 years after the 67 uprising. And it is, so there's still a lot of stuff in the air. There's all this, you know, rage and fear and ugliness and all the white flight going on. But there's also all this music happening, too. That's in the air as well. And, you know, we start off the book, and Danny's listening to CKLW, which is really has turned out to be an iconic radio station at the time, just because they played all different kinds of music.
Very much the top 40, yes.
Yes, but also they played, you know, soul music and folk and
British hard rock,
all this stuff, and Motown and everything. So it really kind of reflected the population of Detroit more so than probably any other radio station. But so there's all this music in the air along with all this other stuff, and that's kind of where the story sort of begins. And we jump forward to Danny going to Redford High School.
Yes, full of fear.
Full of fear.
Predominantly that he's going to become a drug addict. He's afraid he's going to get jumped out and become a drug addict.
Yes, that's pretty much it. He is very concerned about drugs. So, you know, but it's also, a school that is transitioning. It's changing. There are what he calls mini race riots happening pretty frequently. So it is a kind of racially turbulent environment.
And he's trying to find himself in that. And you do such an elegant job of helping us watch Danny grow through the music he listens to. Where did that idea come from that you're going to really hang this story on the music, on the radio stations, on the rock and roll press that was coming out of Detroit?
You know, I was always interested in the idea of a kind of coming of age through music. And I have to say, it's not a super literary thing to say that your book was inspired a little bit by a movie, but I love Almost Famous, the Cameron Crowe film, which is very much the same era as this book. And I kind of wanted to, I don't know, I sort of wanted to write my own version of that, only in Detroit, you know, and where no one is famous. That was important to me. I love the idea of music as this place where generationally, whatever kids are listening to, music just becomes so important, I think, as far as establishing their identity. You know, it's where this one thing that you like what you like, and that sort of tells you the kind of person that you are and where you fit in into the world. And it's something that is often very separate from your parents or what they have, their ideas about who you should be.
Well, and they're carrying their music from their youth. I stop and I think about when I was in school and my father would hear the Hutsut song, or he'd hear Jimmy Dorsey, and he'd start doing that swing thing. And I'd be like, Dad, stop it. But guess who's doing that when she hears the Beatles or the Who today? It doesn't leave you. It holds your heart.
Absolutely true. I really do think that music, and that might be one of those reasons why the music that we kind of come of age to stays with us for all time. I mean, it just becomes part of you.
And it's very striking in Beautiful Music that all three members of Danny's family lean on sound to kind of get them through their troubles and worries. Dad has his records of beautiful music and sound effects, and Mom has that TV that is always turned on. And then Danny has, starting with his top 40 music and then growing into the album-oriented rock stations. So you see that changing, and I think Danny most successfully tames those inner beasts with music. Would you read us an excerpt from Beautiful Music? Here's a passage where Danny is taking comfort in listening to his music.
So I plug my button earphone into my radio and turn it up. The DJ is playing King Crimson's Lark's Tongues in Aspic, Part 1, which is a righteous, crazy, jangly jam. I turn it up just as the tubular bell's percussion segs into shimmery jingle bells and cymbals, then a searing violin section, yes, violins, which raises the hair on the back of my neck just before it builds to a heavy buzzsaw guitar riff that slams my head into the pillow, blasting jagged coils of sound through my noggin, even though I'm just listening to it all through one crappy, tinny little earphone. Just then, my brain downshifts. I go from fourth gear to a steady idle. Mission accomplished. Cream magazine says the best rock is brainless. They're right, because music is one thing that makes me stop thinking about everything, except music, that is. When I put an LP on the turntable, let's say Foghat's first album, and listen to I Just Want to Make Love to You with the boogie chug of that electric guitar and Lonesome Dave's phased vocals that sound like they're being moaned through a broken megaphone, it sends an electric current to my brain that makes me calm inside. It's not just about the words. It's about how music takes us out of ourselves, how it relieves our pains, lets loose something in our hearts, makes us feel better in ways we never knew we could.
That's Michael Zadorian reading a passage from his third novel, Beautiful Music, set in the early 70s in Detroit, where a very not cool kid named Danny Zimsky is using music, using radio, using the rock press to get himself through Redford High School. You do such a powerful job of capturing just how terrifying high school can be, from navigating the halls to the terrors of gym and swim class. I think, speaking as a girl, it was more terrifying for you guys. No bathing suits, boys.
Trying
to dodge the bullies that promise you that you just wait till after school. So as I read it, Beautiful Music almost felt like a memoir, not fiction. Made me wonder, how close is high school Danny to high school Michael?
You know, that's a really good question. I think in a lot of ways, he's a pretty autobiographical character. But I think in a lot of ways, too, he's also someone that I kind of, certain aspects of him are someone I could have been had a few things not gone my way. And so it's interesting to put, you know, things that are autobiographical in your book. And
such as, what are some of the autobiographical things?
There's a scene at the very beginning of the book where Danny actually hears rock music for the first time. It's the MC5, Kick Out the Jams. Mm. And it is, of course, terrifying for him. And
that first line got his ear.
Yeah, yes. And a kid brings in the record. And this is the period in 1969. And a kid brings in the record for show and tell. And he's gonna play it really loud. And it's got a curse on it and everything. If you know this song, you know the curse I'm talking about.
If not, just Google it, folks.
Yes. And That actually happened to me. So that was something that I knew had to go into the book. And it was it's like, yeah, that has definitely gotta go there. So, and there were certainly a few other things. And even the fact that where Danny lives, the high school, I was thinking about, do I need to make up a fictional Detroit high school or something like that? And I thought, why would I do that? I don't need to do that. And so,
just to get on the record, was that your high school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
yeah. All right. So there we have that.
Yeah. So there
you
go.
You know whereof you speak.
Uh-huh. Yes. So, and it made sense to me because I knew that high school and
you knew the neighborhood.
I knew that neighborhood. So it seemed silly. So, and I think a lot of writers will do that. They will take, kind of an environment they know and then make other things happen within that environment.
It's a wonderful coming-of-age story. If you didn't like high school, and most of us didn't, you realize you were not alone here. And if you love music, no matter what the genre, you'll find something to relate in the story of Danny, told by Michael Zadorian in Beautiful Music. Thank you for sharing this book with us. It was a wonderful read.
Thank you so much for having me, Cindy.
Coming up, connecting Michigan veterans to the benefits they may be entitled to.
There are certain benefits I feel like are harder to find out about, and if somebody doesn't tell you, if you don't really do research, then you may never find them.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are about 600,000 veterans in Michigan. That's 11th highest in the nation, according to the U.S. Census. Yet Michigan has consistently ranked in the bottom five states and territories when it comes to helping vets and their families access federal VA benefits. Benefits that could bring much-needed assistance with things like finances, employment, health care. So why aren't more vets in Michigan getting connected to the benefits that they may be entitled to? Today we want to hear how things have changed for vets in Michigan through the decades. We have two veterans who came back from war at two very different times. Lawrence Dolph served in the Army during the Vietnam War from 1968 to 1970. Dan Patrick served with the Marine Corps in Iraq from 2005 to 2009. Lawrence, when you got back home to Michigan after serving in Vietnam, what was it like when you first got back?
This, if I can crib a line from Charles Dickens, is a tale of two cities, the best of times, the worst of times. We know now that about 85% of those who served in Vietnam successfully integrated into civilian life, and I was lucky to be one of those. And 15% came back and were just at a state that they could not right themselves. So what did that mean for Michigan? It meant that about 230,000 of us came back and integrated, got productive jobs, had families, and 40,000 were released in the state that were just a highly visible mess with no support.
Dan, what about you? You come back after serving as a Marine in Iraq. How were things for you?
It was different. I went very early on in the war and just a few years in, so I think there was still a lot of support. I think there were people that kind of understood maybe not exactly why we were there, but I think by that point, after seeing some things, there were a lot of people that had agreed with the initial push in. And by the time I had gotten out, I had been so segregated from the world in a way because I had gotten injured and spent the last bit of my career in a hospital unit. So by the time I came home, it was a different world. And I hadn't realized that people didn't seem to care about what had happened. And to me, it was this huge part of my life that I had just experienced and a huge part of a lot of people's lives and a part of our history and things that were going on. And I felt people need to know. I mean, don't you care what's going on over there? This is the impact it's going to have across the world. And people seem to not hold interest. So I kind of disconnected from that part of my life, and being a veteran was just a thing that I put in a drawer and, let it collect dust. And I just tried to learn to become Dan again. And I just remember that feeling of, I don't know that I'll ever be normal again, and just trying to figure out what normal is, so.
What about finding a job? Here you are transitioning back to being civilian Dan, doing your best to do that. How did it go in finding work?
It was difficult. I think there's a huge disconnect at the time that I got out, and it's getting better. But, we were having vets get out in record numbers. Guys were, just hired from the op tempo, so many deployments so quickly. everything from, you know, right after the surge, then they started a drawdown and their, you know, the Army was thinning out, the Marine Corps was thinning out. And so we had vets getting out all at once. And on top of that, then you're dealing with, do you have the skills? You know, I don't know how many times I've heard the question, well, you know, what's an infantry guy going to do in the real world? There's no job killing people. And so trying to learn to translate these skills and as well as make employers understand that, you know, these are the kind of things that are going to translate well into the business world or translate well into, you know, the retail world, whatever it is that, you know, you might be hiring for.
And as you talk with other vets that were kind of from your cohort, were they having similar experiences?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, it's a big problem across the board. I know so many guys that I meet now and they still don't understand how to translate certain military service into skills. And so teaching people and like I said, learning myself that, okay, well, what does military experience have? You know, you can say infantry, but if you put that, you're probably not gonna get hired. Now, if I say, you know, time management, I was great at leading people. You know, there's a million different skills that you learn in the military that build you as a person and build you as an employee. It's just whether or not, you know, people get that.
And Lori, how did that compare to your experience when you came back from Vietnam?
Well, and I have to stress that I can speak to my personal experience. And there were 2.7 million Vietnam veterans, and I'm just one of them. And my experience is not typical or atypical. I make no claims other than to report what I experienced. Michigan was, actually the entire United States, was in this big boom that went from 1970 to year 2000. Gross national product would run as high as 14%, never below 4%. I mean, we can't get to 4% today in this environment that Dan and his cohorts are trying to get work in. We had this boom. There was a desperate need for people. The way the organizations, corporations reacted to our training, they appreciated our initiative. We could identify a problem, and we would move to solve that problem. And they said, good, we need you.
Lori, how about government benefits, government assistance? What was there for you, and how difficult was it for you to access it when you got back from Vietnam?
Well, the Michigan legislature, quite amazingly, voted $500 for those of us who could submit a DD-214 form of proof of service. That'd be more than $3,000 today, and that was much appreciated. But the guys who were in trouble didn't have the wherewithal to get the form in the mail and get the money. So in a sense, the people who needed it couldn't get it. The federal government had probably most notably the GI Bill. And while it's never quite enough, there's enough workaround that between the GI Bill and the work that's available, you could go to school, you could go to graduate school. And that's one of the reasons why 10 years after the Vietnam War, Vietnam veterans ended up being considerably better educated than those of their peers who did not go. An amazing fact people don't know.
How about you, Dan? How difficult was it to access services and get help doing that?
So I'll say, you know, we've once again come leaps and bounds from where we used to be. And I think, you know, I was very lucky in the sense that I did have a lot of benefits. You know, the GI Bill that Lori talks about, they had come out with the post 9/11 GI Bill by the time I had gotten out. And thankfully I had, I don't know how many, countless number of Vietnam vets that kept telling me, hey, use your GI Bill, use your GI Bill. So there were these benefits. The flip side to that is that many of them are not easy to navigate and access. And I think when I got out, and I know now that there's even programs in place for this, there's still people now that get out that have a difficulty trying to navigate the system because it's not easy. And there are certain benefits I feel like are harder to find out about. And if somebody doesn't tell you, if you don't really do research, then you may never find them. And I know so many vets that have years later have gotten benefits that they should have had since the moment they got out.
You know, we think about Michigan, our state ranks in the bottom five states for federal spending on veterans. Why are we so low in your view, Dan?
The biggest issue to it is probably that we're a Garden Reserve state. I don't know the answer for sure.
But what does that mean?
Feels like.
So why would that affect it?
Because we don't have an active duty base, I think it's we're not used to seeing the impact of the military and the impact of what our Michiganders who go and join actually means, because you don't see people in uniform very often. You don't see, you know, helicopters and jets flying over on a regular basis.
Unless you live out by Selfridge.
Yeah, that's true. But which is still, Selfridge is mostly a reserve base.
Yes,
so
true.
I think, unfortunately and fairly, though, I will say that can't be the only reason, because Wisconsin as well is a Garden Reserve state, and they go beyond for their veterans.
Hmm. Well, Loria, what are your thoughts on why we have such a low amount of federal spending?
Many veterans, particularly combat veterans, come from either hugely disadvantaged sectors of urban centers, Detroit, for example, or they come from very small towns all over Michigan. And they return to these towns, and the economic base of these towns has collapsed. And it wasn't there in the inner cities to begin with for a long time, and probably still isn't. So I think you left from nothing. You served your country, and you came back home to nothing, and nothing was getting worse because they tore up the railroad. That was gone. So the lumber business was gone. So the potato business was gone. And the mines closed in the UP, and people just felt stuck. And the government benefits didn't seem perhaps relevant if you could find out about them.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Marine Corps veteran Dan Patrick, who served in the Corps from 2005 to 2009 and saw combat in Iraq. And we're also speaking with U.S. Army Vietnam veteran Laurie Dolph, who served from 1968 to 1970. Based on your knowledge and what you hear from your fellow soldiers and Marines about their experiences in other states, how would you describe what it is like to be a veteran in Michigan right now compared to what you hear from folks in other states? What do you think, Dan?
I think as a whole, we're pretty tired as a nation. It's been a long, long road. And I think because of that, there's kind of a disconnect. And so it's hard in Michigan when you feel like, well, at least, you know, the state will recognize, or at least the, you know, local government will recognize. And I think without that being the case, there's a lot of people that feel, you know, sort of slighted. And so that is the reason that we see people leaving the state to go to other states, because there are states that, you know, go above and beyond to make sure that their veterans are recognized. And clearly that's not the reason we do it. And most of us, we'd really just want to see our families taken care of, or you know, even the most basic things. But I think when there is a state, or there are, you know, local governments that go out of their way to make sure that veterans are recognized, I think that does help. It does kind of remind us that, you know, people do care about what we did, because it was such a big part of our lives.
Well, Dan, you mentioned Wisconsin. So what's Wisconsin doing that we're not doing here?
You know, there's a lot of simple things that, you know, I've talked to other vets about that don't seem like a big deal, and they're really not. But it's those little things like, you know, there's states like Wisconsin, several states that do free hunting licenses and fishing licenses for veterans, you know, not just for 100% disabled, for vets, and say, hey, you know. And I don't know any vet that I've ever met personally that has ever looked for handouts. It's just the fact that states need to recognize certain things, I think. And, you know, a really big part of it is other states have programs that we have, but they're state funded. And these are programs that specifically go out and reach out to veterans to help with employment, to help with putting them in the right track, to make sure that if they have legal issues, because that's another big aspect of, you know, coming home. I think I know Vietnam vets had the same issue that, you know, there were legal aspects from people who had maybe made mistakes because they didn't have time to decompress and they had challenges. And like I said, all these things are getting better. I don't want to throw the state down and say that none of this has happened. This is just from my view when I had first come home.
How can Michigan do better by its veterans? What would you like to see change, Dan?
You know, I think, once again, like I said, there are programs out there that are doing amazing things in our state. I think that when I see programs like Buddy to Buddy, there are people over there that are doing amazing work to reach out to veterans. And they are that bridge between all these services and the veteran themselves. These are programs that go out and then they have to, you know, fundraise, they have to find grants. And these are programs that should get more state support because they are making huge impacts on our veterans across the board. They are doing things like teaching these veterans how to translate their skills and, you know, helping them with any medical issues or getting benefits that they never knew they had. As well as, you know, one of the biggest things I've heard that is a complaint across the board, and this is in a lot of states, is the transition from certain training in the military to the civilian side. I know guys who were docs and corpsmen, and these gentlemen can't even get a job as an EMT. They can drive the ambulance, but they can't care for anyone because, well, we don't honor this certificate. And the truth is, these guys are doing more with less in the battlefield, stopping a sucking chest wound with what's at hand. And yet their skills aren't considered transferable because maybe somebody went to a class that is state certified, quote unquote. So I think there's a way that the state could kind of change the balance of, well, what is considered transferable? Why, is there this blockage between somebody who spent a long time learning this and knows it, and yet now they have to spend a lot more time before they can even get a decent job?
So when you talk about buddy-to-buddy and programs like that, we've got a state agency. So what's missing?
We do. The problem with that is that while the state has, taken steps forward from where we used to be, and especially from where we were at when Lori was coming home, there are also a lot of programs that are very successful, and the majority of those are not state funded. The majority of those are nonprofits. They are privately funded. They are people that are going out and fighting for grants just to stay alive. And yet, based off of what we've seen, are far more effective than state programs.
All right. What about you?
Well, I fully agree with Dan. From my perspective, we have to do more to prepare the organization to recognize the value of the veterans we get back. These are the 85% who are not troubled, are exceptional people of exceptional capabilities, and HR departments need to get off their butts and recognize the equivalencies in training these people have received, men and women, that would be of great value to those organizations. You're talking about leadership, you're talking about innovation. Veterans identify problems, solve problems, have incredible people skills, pull together diverse groups of people and make them work on the same thing, which is the biggest deal, because you have disputes in any organization, people from different backgrounds. How do you get people to work on the right stuff? Veterans can help you do that.
What are we losing when veterans don't get the resources that they're entitled to?
Well, there's a long string, I think, answer to that question. Unfortunately, one aspect of that is I think we're losing veterans. I'm not saying that's the only reason why. Obviously, there's multiple reasons, but we are losing veterans at a record number.
Are you talking about suicide?
I am. And that's a lot of that, I think, comes with guys who maybe aren't getting all the benefits that they need or all the resources. And I'm not just talking, monetarily or anything else, but even just the health care. There is still a lack in care for PTSD and mental health. I think obviously, we've seen through things in the civilian world, there is a mental health issue in this country. And, when guys aren't receiving the care, the benefits that they need, or connected with programs like Buddy to Buddy, I think that, we're losing veterans because of that. And on top of that, I think we lose the desire for people to want to continue to serve. There are a lot of veterans that have come home that I know that have continued to serve the way they did in the military and have served their brothers and sisters as well as civilians around them in their communities and have done amazing things. And they have that desire to continue to serve. And I think there are people that when they don't have those benefits or they aren't quote unquote paid for their services, they kind of lose that desire to serve. And it does affect the communities, I think.
I agree with that, but the organizations lose too. Many veterans come back and they feel that the organization doesn't have a clearly defined mission, that people are not on the same team, that they in fact are undermining one another, backstabbing one another. This is not teamwork. This is not fulfilling a mission. And the veterans are very frustrated at the chaos they encounter in these organizations, and it's very depressing. The difference is the veterans know how good it can be and how they could fix it. Whereas I think people who have not served just think, well, this is just how life is, and they put up with it. So we lose the know-how of the veterans, and at the same time, we lose future veterans, not just from suicides, but the volunteer military is having a harder and harder time getting people to enlist because the example of people coming back and what happens to them when they come back is just deplorable. And, who would want to sign up for that kind of a program?
Lori Dolph, U.S. Army veteran, Vietnam combat veteran, and Dan Patrick, U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Iraq combat veteran. I hope it is not trite to say thanks to both of you for your service because it's very much from the heart, and we want to thank you for being with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, yes.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Katie Raymond, Laura Weber-Davis, and Joey Horan.
Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.